I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Scientific exploration is a force for good in the world, at least it can be. But it's also brought the world frontal lobotomies, rampant heart disease, and the crisis of opioid addiction. Today, what happens when breakthroughs go astray, stories of science gone wrong, and whether it's possible to have the benefits without the costs. Then, for African Americans interested in engineering, discovering black role models in the field can be tough. As thousands of their peers come to Kansas City this week, we talk with local engineers of color about the challenges and the opportunities. Plus, another look at the upcoming vote on Kansas City's $800 million bond for infrastructure. Not everyone's a fan. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Science is good. Inventions and breakthroughs through all of recorded history have extended lives, improved health, and made the world an all-around better place. And they've also killed millions and condemned people to addiction and pain and unleashed some of the greatest horrors the world has ever known. That history of good science gone bad is our topic today, along with what it means for our present and our future. And our guide is Dr. Paul Offit. He directs the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's also the author of 9 books, and the latest one's called Pandora's Lab. He joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Dr. Paul Offit, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. So the book's subtitle is 7 Stories of Science Gone Wrong, and maybe the place to start is with one of those stories. I thought I might ask about one that's probably touched just about every American, and that's the great invention we call margarine. How long ago did we get our first taste of this particular delight?
Well, actually, I mean, it's from the late 1800s. It got its boost in the 1960s when a scientist named Ansel Keys said that basically fat was bad and that we should severely restrict the amount of fat in our diet. And so butter, which contained animal fat, became evil. And margarine, on the other hand, became the heart-healthy alternative. He even coined the phrase heart-healthy diet. And so
the fat is bad, isn't it?
Well, he had drove us into margarine was partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, which contain, you know, fairly large quantities of trans fats. Now we know that quantity of trans fats was estimated by the Harvard School of Public Health to cause as many as 250,000 heart-related deaths a year. So that was a bad idea.
I should say so. And how did that become a solution that was offered? I mean, butter was pretty well ingrained in society by that point.
Yeah, for centuries. Right. I think, you know, it was based on very flimsy data. So fats became evil, and then sort of all saturated fats became evil. And what we now know, I mean, trans fats is actually an unsaturated fat, and it's based on partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. And that became, you know, vegetables sounded better than animal fat. And so, you know, even Eleanor Roosevelt was sort of telling us that we should be using margarine as she was spreading it on her breakfast toast in the morning. And we were driven into the arms of trans fats, which did an enormous amount of harm. I mean, for all the controversies associated with diet, the notion that trans fats is harmful has never been controversial. It's without parallel in terms of its harm.
Well, you mentioned this flimsy data, which is sort of a theme that runs through a number of the stories you tell in this book. Science comes up with solutions, it roots them in evidence, but then it turns out the evidence changes over the years, right?
Yeah, I think one should make a distinction between science and scientists. Scientists get it wrong all the time. That's okay. That's the process. I mean, it's sort of highly mutable and probing and questioning. And what you find over time is that truths do emerge. If the scientist is wrong, then there's no hiding. Time will show that he's wrong, he or she is wrong. And science, however, does get it right. So I think truths do emerge over time. And when they emerge, we look back and realize the mistakes we've made.
What's the lesson that we learn from margarine and trans fats at this point?
The lesson was that the simple solutions weren't a good one. That, you know, the notion that all fats were bad was a little simplistic. The notion that all saturated fats was bad and all unsaturated fats were good was simplistic. And as we got better at understanding that there were different kinds of cholesterol, different kinds of sort of low density or high density lipoprotein cholesterols, we learned more, we understood what the interactions were. But it took time. We didn't know enough to make the recommendations we made when we made them.
Well, starting starting with that example, then I wanted to sort of take a step back and ask how this project came to be, how you came to write this book. I mean, you've written about autism, you've written about vaccines, you work in a children's hospital, you see all the promise of science. Why take this sort of dark turn?
That's what happens when you get older. Just everything looks darker. Now,
I think what
happened, so my son and I were visiting the Franklin Institute, which is a science institute here in Philadelphia, and they had an exhibition called 101 Inventions That Changed the World. And a couple of those inventions were surprising. One was gunpowder. One was atomic energy or nuclear energy. And, I argued with him, you could argue these things did more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came up with this list of what we thought were inventions that changed the world for the worse. And as I sort of gave talks over the years, I would ask people what they thought should be on that list. And that ultimately, these seven are the ones that survived.
You title the book Pandora's Lab, which makes reference to the myth of Pandora with the box of horrors that gets opened up. I mean, is that maybe a little dramatic, or do you think this is kind of a world-changing release of evil that happens through well-meaning scientific efforts?
No, I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, the first story I tell is sort of humankind's first medicine, which is opium. And we've been paying the price for that discovery for, 25 or 6,000 years, really. The Sumerians were the first to come up with opium. But, we kept believing wrongly that we could separate pain relief from addiction. And so, opium users became opium addicts. Then we purified the main ingredient of opium, which was morphine. And so opium addicts became morphine addicts. And then we chemically modified morphine to create something called diacetylmorphine, which we now call heroin. And so morphine addicts became heroin addicts. And then we modified another component of opium called thebaine to make oxycodone. And so now heroin addicts become opioid addicts. It's a lesson we've never learned. And goodness knows we have paid a price for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, and one that also has policy consequences, one that has public health costs. Your title of that chapter about opium is called God's Own Medicine, which I think is interesting. You've brought in sort of the metaphysical elements that get tied up in all of this.
Yeah, well, it's actually William Osler, who's sort of a giant in the field of medicine, created that phrase, God's own medicine, because certainly in the face of pain, there are no heroes. I mean, pain brings us all to our knees. I think what happened was, though, in the 1990s, we came to believe that no one should suffer a moment of pain, and that we should make pain the fifth vital sign, and no one should walk into a doctor's office and not be asked in the first three questions whether or not they're in any pain. And I think we swung far too much in the other direction and are paying the price for that.
You talked about kind of the impact of opium addiction on the world. I was struck by how once it took hold in a certain place, the depth and the breadth of how quickly it spread. So you talked about, for example, how in China, in the, I guess it was the 18th century, it went from nobody ever having heard of opium to a full-fledged breakdown of the country.
Right. Enslaved a nation. And then, Chinese immigrants came to the West Coast and they brought their opium pipes with them. And it was off to the races here as well. So you're right. There was a Chinese influence in the West, especially regarding opium smoking, that helped to launch this debacle.
Here in Missouri, our General Assembly is debating a prescription drug monitoring program that supporters say would help fight opioid addiction. We are the only state in the union without one of those drug monitoring programs. And it just sort of strikes me that even to this day, it's difficult for society, for legislative bodies, or for leaders to really get their head around problems that are started by these scientific discoveries.
Right. And I think the hardest part here is that we need to control the demand. I think, if, for example, when you hear President Trump talk about building a wall and trying to keep, presumably heroin primarily from coming into the country, the fact of the matter is most of the opioid addiction is based on prescription painkillers that doctors prescribe. And as long as there is a demand, there's going to be a supply. There is no preventing that. And I think, so the fear that there'll be a cutback on these substance abuse programs will do little to lessen demand. And that's really where we have to focus our efforts.
I'm wondering, science is sort of having a rough go of it in a lot of quarters these days. There's those who deny climate change in spite of evidence to the contrary. There's those who oppose vaccinating children, again, in spite of evidence. Are you concerned that bad-mouthing science right now might have some negative policy consequences?
Right. I think in some ways I've misled people with a subtitle. When I say Seven Stories of Science Going Wrong, I don't think science has really gone wrong. I think that science ultimately stands the test of time. It's really scientists that make a or sort of doggedly hold on to a particular bias and put forward that bias, and then they're wrong. But ultimately they are shown to be wrong. In the case of trans fats, we know that Ansel Keys' notion that all fats were bad was wrong, and we know the notion that all saturated fats are good and all saturated fats are bad and all unsaturated fats are good or wrong. So we do find that out over time. But you're right. I mean, it's climate change denialism. It's evolution denialism, i.e. creationism. It's vaccine denialism. You're right. I think we've sort of entered this anti-enlightenment age where evidence really doesn't matter and that science at some level is losing its position as a place of truth. And that's dangerous.
So what's the middle ground then to say science to lift up the value of science, but at the same time express this voice of caution you're trying to sound?
Well, so I guess what I would say is that one shouldn't be impressed by a single study, that if somebody makes a fantastic claim, as for example, when Andrew Wakefield publishes a paper claiming that the measles, mumps, rubella or MMR vaccine causes autism, that we should wait to see whether or not that extraordinary claim, which was frankly backed up by no evidence, but that it should be backed up ultimately by extraordinary evidence. And now we have 17 studies done in 7 countries on 3 continents that showed that was wrong. And so a truth emerged. MMR doesn't cause autism. And I think that's science. I mean, scientific truths may not emerge in a day or a week or even a year or even a decade, but they do emerge. And when they emerge, then you know that you have a fact. I mean, evolution is a fact. Climate change is a fact. That vaccines are safe, that MMR doesn't cause autism. Those are facts. And I think when people then deny those facts, which are well hewn by, by decades often of research, that's when I think you have to worry. So you're right. I think we have to worry.
You are not just a writer. You've actually invented a vaccine yourself, right?
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Right. So fortunate enough to be part of a team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia with researchers like Stan Plotkin and Fred Clark that develops something called the rotavirus vaccine. So rotaviruses are a virus that cause fever and vomiting and diarrhea in young children. In this country, it would cause about 75,000 children to be hospitalized a year and about 60 to die. But in the developing world, it causes about 2,000 deaths a day. So, I was fortunate to be enough to be part of that program. And I certainly learned a lot about how difficult it is to make vaccines. And while I was doing that, I also learned how easy it was to damn them, given some of the statements that people make about vaccines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as someone who has come up with one of these real breakthroughs, I guess I wonder, what if it went wrong? I mean, in the way that some of these other breakthroughs have gone wrong. And I mean, do you know that it won't?
Well, no, you don't. Well, I think now you know. I mean, because the vaccine was licensed and recommended, has been given, hundreds of millions of doses have been given since 2006.
But I mean, opium looked pretty good for a lot of years, too.
No, it looked great. I think you don't know. And Maurice Hilleman, who I consider to be the father of modern vaccines, as he invented, frankly, 9 of the 14 that we currently give to children today, said it best. He said, "I never breathe a sigh of relief until the first 3 million doses are out there." And that's not going to happen pre-licensure. So you don't know. And I think when our vaccine was licensed and recommended in 2006, me and my co-inventors held our breath in the hopes that all the data we'd done pre-licensure, it was in fact correct. And it was a big pre-licensure study. It was a 70,000-person prospective, placebo-controlled, 11-country, 4-year, $350 million trial. It wasn't a trial, but you never really know. And so you're right. You learn over time, and sometimes you learn something you didn't want to learn. You're right. You have to wait.
I want to talk about another one of these stories out of the book, and I guess I want to start by saying most of the breakthroughs you describe, I think to myself, yeah, obviously that seemed like a great discovery, something that makes pain go away, or a fertilizer that makes plants grow, but it's hard to believe that drilling holes in people's heads and taking out part of their brain ever seemed like a good idea.
I guess you had to be there.
I think so.
At the time in the 1930s and 40s in this country and in other countries in the world, there were large institutions that housed people who had severe mental disabilities such as schizophrenia, for which there was nothing to offer, and some of these people were violent. And I think at the time the lobotomies were one of the many therapies of despair. There was so-called insulin shock therapy, electroshock therapy, which still exists and is of value. in some cases, and another a drug induced shock therapy. I mean, snake pits were basically a shock therapy for people who had severe mental illnesses. And I think what this did was it just basically made people apathetic. It calmed them down. It made them vegetative. And I think we look back now at that with horror, and we should. But a lot of the drugs also that came in the 1950s, like Thorazine, et cetera, also were served in some ways a similar function of sort of calming people down. I think it was a tragedy. We did 20,000 lobotomies in this country, and frankly, 7,000 of them were done by one man, and it was a Philadelphian who trained at, you know, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, which is where I work. So I guess at some level, Philadelphia is responsible.
But I mean, the inventors of this won the Nobel Prize, right?
Right. Nobel Prize won. Egas Moniz was a Portuguese neurologist who for his work that he started in 1935, won the Nobel Prize in 1949. And his work was praised by the New England Journal of Medicine as breakthrough. It was praised by the New York Times as a major breakthrough in the way that we see the brain. So at the time, this was considered just miraculous. And now we look back on it and see it as a horror movie.
This does stand in contrast to some of the other stories we talked about, though, in that in this case, the problem does seem to have gone back into the box. They're not doing lobotomies anymore, right?
Right.
Is there a word of instruction there for how you solve these problems if they are unleashed?
I think at the time, people, you know, take Joe Kennedy. I mean, Joe Kennedy's daughter, Rosemary Kennedy, was frankly mildly disabled. She was functional. She could read. She could write. She could go to a party. But she was clearly delayed as compared to her brothers and sisters who, you know, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, I mean, these were active, smart, you know, people. And she lagged behind them. And he wanted a miracle. And so he went to this Walter Freeman, who was the nation's lobotomist, frankly. And Freeman convinced him that this would dramatically alter his daughter so that she would be all better. And he wanted to believe it. And so he didn't talk to other people who had lobotomies or didn't talk to other neurologists or neurosurgeons who at that point were frankly damning the procedure because he wanted to believe in the magic. And that's where he paid a price, and his daughter paid an enormous price.
I want to take a step back from all of the stories and sort of ask a bigger question. As you look at the scientific pursuit, how do we keep science from going astray? Or is that the right question? Can we possibly keep these things from happening?
I think science is enormously self-correcting because it's constantly challenging itself to make sure it's right. And I think, but for especially when it comes to issues of health, that's disconcerting. We'd like to believe that we know everything we need to know right now, especially when it concerns our own health, knowing full well that we're going to know much more 100 years from now than we do now. And I think that sort of puts us at risk for being influenced by what I would call the guru phenomenon. I mean, people like Mehmet Oz or Deepak Chopra, they don't question themselves. They have all the answers. And I think that is enormously seductive, and it's a mistake to be that seduced.
Are the popular scientists like the ones you name, are they actually causing a problem for real? I'm sorry, that's very judgmental, but for scientists in the labs?
Sure. I think also one of the problems is as a scientist, I think we're not very good about getting in the game. I mean, stepping up to the microphone or stepping up in front of the camera and explaining what we do, because we should. I was funded by the National Institutes of Health for more than 25 years, and that's public money. I mean, the taxpayer was paying my salary. And I think, you know, science is a privilege. It's not a right. It can easily be taken away from us. And if you look at this sort of draconian NIH budget that was put forward by President Trump, we'll see whether that plays out. But I think we really need to explain what we do, why we do what we do, and what the strengths and limitations of science are so people can appreciate that.
Draconian because of the cuts is what you're saying.
Yes, draconian because of the cuts, exactly.
So it does seem like there's maybe possibly contradictory messages, though, that there's this cautionary note to not overdo it, to not be too ambitious and thus lose caution about what you invent, but at the same time, you want to keep up the levels of research and funding.
Yes, you want to keep pushing forward, realizing that science and nature gives itself up slowly and that we have to be cautious as we move forward, but not and so be skeptical, but don't be cynical. And so, for example, genetically modified organisms are of tremendous value, and yet we're scared of them. I think, you know, the term people use is frankenfoods, even though there is no evidence that the genetically modified foods are in any sense dangerous. And they have better nutrient profiles, they're increased production. There's much good that's come with genetically modified organisms. But the notion that it's scientific, it's the literal monster, I think, in some ways, that, you know, Mary Shelley described when she described, you know, Victor Frankenstein's making Frankenstein. And I think that's how people, they're not quite sure they understand genetic modification, and so they instantly fear it and are willing to reject it. And that's where I think we make a mistake.
So there's one that people are afraid of, but maybe they don't need to be. As you look out at the current horizon and maybe even the buffet of scientific innovation that's happening right now, are there any that you think we should be worried about, things that get a lot of positive attention that maybe are just waiting at the edge of Pandora's box?
Yes, I do. I think that in our interest to prevent cancer or to treat cancers earlier rather than later, I think we've been a little too aggressive. The inventions of PSAs, prostate-specific antigens, as a way of determining who is likely to go on to develop fatal prostate cancers has been a vast overhaul. I think it's made for a lot of unnecessary surgeries, a lot of unnecessary radiation. You can make the same argument for mastectomies with the so-called ductal carcinoma in situ, that these are cancers, same thing with a lot of thyroid cancers, that these are cancers that you're going to die with and not from, and that by doing the kind of aggressive surgeries and radiation therapy that we'd be doing more harm than good, because there are a lot of data that suggests that this aggressive approach doesn't necessarily make us live longer. So I think people need to be careful of that in terms of how they approach it.
You know, one more story you tell in the book is in some ways maybe the most horrifying, and it starts with the very positive learning of scientists about the way genetics work. Tell us how that came to be, and then how that turns into a science gone wrong.
Yeah, that to me was the most horrifying story. I mean, I would argue that the probably the most popular scientific treatise ever written was written by Madison Grant, who was a New York City lawyer and conservationist, who he called it the passing of the great race. He believed that his race, which he called the Nordic race, was being overrun by people coming into this country from what he called the lesser races. So instead of coming from England or Scandinavia or Germany, they were coming from, you know, Poland or Eastern Europe and, you know, Jews, et cetera. And this was somehow diluting out his Nordic race. And so because of that book, there were a series of four restrictive immigration laws in the 1920s that slowed immigration to a trickle. In a sense, he wanted to make America America again. And that book, which sold 1.6 million copies, was in 1925 translated into German, where it was read by a young German corporal in the Landsberg prison, that he was imprisoned because of his role in an uprising in Bavaria. And so he wrote a letter to Madison Grant saying, quote, "This book is my Bible." Then he took whole passages from that book, The Passing of the Great Race, and put it in his book, Mein Kampf. And The Passing of the Great Race became required reading for young Germans when Hitler came into power. And race purity met its illogical, hideous end.
It's a case where some pretty cool science, learning about how genetic traits are passed on, turns into something awful, not because of the science, but because of, well, the people.
Right. No, Mendel, you know, defined how, you know, specific physical characteristics of plants could be transmitted by what he called factors. Now we know them as genes. That was perverted by Francis Galton, who then said that the genes could determine not only physical characteristics, but also, you know, whether you were loyal or whether you were brave or whether you would turn to prostitution. And so he invented the field called eugenics, which, you know, literally means well-born. And that was very popular in the United States, taught at all the major universities, that we should sort of encourage people who are the better people among us to breed. And then, you know, I think Madison Grant took it the next step further, which is to say that this was also a phenomenon of race, that there were inferior and superior races. And that then met its illogical end. In Germany, I mean, that's what Rudolf Hess, who was Hitler's deputy Führer, said. He said, "Nazi socialism is nothing but applied biology."
Wow. But Paul Offit, before we let you go, you end the book with a pretty lengthy section on the lessons that you hope people learn. Leave us with one lesson. What's a lesson from the past that you hope those in science and outside of it are thinking about going forward?
Well, I think we should never be seduced by the single study, especially if it makes an extraordinary claim. As Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims should be backed by extraordinary evidence. When you read something amazing, like MMR is the cause of autism, for example, the MMR vaccine, you should be suspicious of that right away and wait for a moment to see whether it's going to be reproduced. And we don't do that. We all sort of fall into this single study trap.
The book is called Pandora's Lab. It comes out next week. Dr. Paul Offit joined us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about a big meeting for African Americans in engineering this week in Kansas City, plus a look at next week's big vote in Kansas City on an $800 million bond. Some in the community have concerns. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we learned about smarter urban design and a new play that explores what's happening to free speech. Find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. And join us Monday. Political consultant and ABC News analyst Matthew Dowd is our guest, so join us then. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the Kansas City ballot issue next week that would authorize $800 million in general obligation bonds to pay for the city's infrastructure needs. It's a big ask, and not everyone's happy about it. But first, some folks who know something about infrastructure, engineers, and specifically the National Society of Black Engineers, which is holding its annual convention in Kansas City as we speak down at Bartle Hall. We're living in a time where national leaders talk about investing billions in repairing and upgrading the country's roads and utilities. But what does that all mean for the engineers who will be called on to do that work? And what's the environment for people of color in the industry? Joining me today are two guests who've not only been active with that organization, they're part of the local community of black engineers. Dejon Slaughter is Community and Citizenship Director for the Turner Construction Company here in Kansas City. Dejon, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us today. And we're excited to share our story, share what NESI is about, and share what we do in this community.
It's great to have you here. And also George White Jr., he's an engineer with Black & Veatch, whose headquarters are in Overland Park. Hi, George.
Hello. How are you today?
Doing great. Thanks for both of you for being here. I know you're both UMKC grads as well, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yes,
got
right.
Your
Kangaroos.
Your training and your work is local. yeah, that's right. Go Roos. So, Dejon, I've read that that the NSBE was founded in 1975. It's got more than 31,000 members worldwide. Why does there need to be an organization specifically for engineers of color?
Absolutely. That's a great question, Brian. And that was something that I often ask myself, you know, why is there a need to have a exclusive organization for black engineers? But, you know, when I was a student at UMKC and I looked around in the classroom, I didn't really see too many black engineers in our classroom, you know, and there's definitely a need to have folks that look like you and think like you.
Why is that?
Together. Yeah, just in our industry, there isn't a huge presence. Mm-hmm. It's growing. The initiative is growing for it, but it's definitely a huge need to have a camaraderie and inclusiveness together. Just because when you look around in the classroom, when you look around in industry, the majority of folks aren't minorities.
George, how did you get involved in, or at least interested in engineering? What made you think, especially given the lack of other African-Americans in the field, that this was something you wanted to do?
Sure. So I actually went to school to William Jewell to play football. And William Jewell at the time didn't have an engineering program. I think they do now. But essentially, I went to school, got a business degree. And then my senior year at Jewell, I'm looking around trying to figure out exactly, you know, what business sense I want to go into. And I just kept hearing this voice in my ear saying, you know, engineering, science, technology, and that type of thing. And so I made the decision to go to the community college system and get into engineering. I got an associate's from the Metropolitan Community College System, which I must say is great. I have no knocks on the community college system. It's a great avenue.
And this was after you'd already got your bachelor's degree.
Yes,
that's
right.
From Jewell.
That's right. So I got another bachelor's, but we won't talk about that.
Yeah, so this led you into this field. Were you surprised at how few African Americans there were in the field?
You know, I really didn't know what to expect getting into it. But once I did get to the actual engineering curriculum within UMKC, I noticed that, you know, there weren't many of us. And, you know, societies like NSBE, the National Society of Black Engineers, is extremely helpful in that sense. it forms a sense of camaraderie where you and your peers can get together and you can, you know, study for tests together, or you can go and go to the national conventions. And that's really the powerful part, is when you go to the national conventions, because like here in Kansas City, what we have going on this week, there's 10,000 black and minority engineering students in one place. I couldn't even imagine what that looked like before I'd seen it. And it's just very, very impactful.
Dejan, when did you realize that that your interests might lead to a career in engineering?
It all started in high school for me. And I went to Sumner Academy over in KCK, Wyandotte County. And that was when I was first exposed to Autodesk and AutoCAD and Revit. And those are all softwares commonly used in our industry, you know, as architects, engineers, and construction builders. And that was really the first time I really was exposed to what's out there and what's possible. And we had a great teacher there that really explained to us, oh, you may have a potential as an engineer someday. So that's kind of where I got exposed to engineering and my passion grown to be in this industry.
Yeah, we mentioned that you both went to UMKC. Was Kansas City a good place to be getting started in this career? Is this a good place for engineers, Dejan?
I definitely would say so. This is definitely a hub for engineering and construction, of course, with Turner Construction here and many of our other competitors. But just a really good place to work and live, you know, as an engineer. As you could look around, there's tower cranes everywhere. There's so much development going on. And you have so many engineers coming from different places coming to Kansas City because so many headquartered companies are here. So it just makes sense that Kansas City becomes the hub and maintains to be the hub in the middle of America for sure.
George, you mentioned how important and how powerful it is to go to a convention like the one going on right now and see other people of color in engineering.
Yes.
I guess I'm curious, why does that matter? Why would it matter for you to have role models or peers who are also African Americans as you make your way in this field?
Well, engineering as a whole is not an easy field to go into. And so when you go to school and you don't see very many black engineers, but then you go to this conference and you see, you know, 10,000 other people like you that are going through the same challenges, that's extremely empowering. And it kind of realizes that, okay, it's not just me. There are several people that are kind of going through the same things. And when you go to the conference, it's about a week long, and you you're talking to these kids from all around the world, and you're learning about their dreams, their aspirations, and it just empowers you even more to live your dreams out.
Yeah, and to add something to that, if I could.
Please.
It creates a support system for us. For example, you know, one of both of our mentors is Joe Davis, and he's the CEO of his own company of a mechanical engineering firm here in town. And we actually met him through NSBE, you know, by being involved on campus. And, you know, we still are really connected with him now. And that just created a network of folks that we really didn't know were out there that we can lean on as a support system. And being a part of NSBE, you know, we have, you know, many other colleagues in the industry now that we can continue to keep in touch with.
Talking about NSBE, the National Society of Black Engineers, you both have been involved in that organization one way or another. Why do you think African Americans are underrepresented in the engineering field? I mean, why does that come to be?
I would say, from my own personal testimony, just growing up, you know, I didn't see any black engineers in the community, you know, even in my neighborhood. And that was something that I think should change. And just making that cool, you know, making that cool in our community, because, you know, once these students see the opportunities that are out there and available for them, and they see folks like George and I, you know, doing the right thing and having successful careers in this industry, that would hopefully change the way that you know our kids in our communities think about, you know, engineers and STEM and having a successful career in this industry.
George, how are you making engineering cool? That's what I wanted to know.
How am I making it cool? Well, I volunteered to coach a Rube Goldberg team just a few weeks ago. The competition was just a few weeks ago, and it was with Black and Veatch hosts the competition here locally. And I coached a team of kids through Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And essentially, I brought in all the materials. I brought all the kids together, and we built a Rube Goldberg machine, which is essentially, Rube Goldberg was a cartoonist in, I believe, the 1800s, which came up with these elaborate cartoons of doing...
It's like where the toaster pops up and it hits a domino that falls into a jar of water. Yeah.
Exactly. And there was a local competition, or a global, excuse me, competition here. And so I coached that, and just having those kids see me or someone that looks like me in the role to show them how to do these things is what is of utmost importance. Because like Dejan, when I was growing up, I didn't know any black engineers either.
Sure.
My grandfather was a master pipe fitter and a master plumber. My father was a pipe fitter. So I knew about the trade side, but I always wanted to use my brain to try and do things and less so more my hands. And so that's kind of what I do to make it cool.
I would say George's being really modest right now. Something that's really
You're
cool.
You're going to tell us how cool he is?
Yeah, he's really cool. He actually spent a week in Washington, D.C. He won, I think, Black Engineer of the Year for a national organization. And he had an opportunity to give his testimony. And that's really cool, just having these students see, oh, man, like, I have an opportunity to go to Washington, D.C., meet all these great people because of what I'm doing in a career. You know, that's really cool. So stop being modest, man.
That's true.
George, so you've won this award for community involvement. A big part of your work, Dejan, is reaching out to the community, right?
Absolutely.
You've both been doing this for a few years. What are you seeing in terms of recruiting and hiring? Is the trend heading in a positive direction? In maybe locally and nationally? Do you think more people of color are entering the field, George?
Absolutely, I do. I think there's been a national push for STEM outreach, and it's been great to see more people of color getting into the STEM fields. I think the natural organic growth of the NSBE convention every year kind of speaks to that. I think they're at about 10,000 people.
Yeah, 10 or 11,000.
Yeah. What goes on at the convention anyway? Oh, what are we missing down at Bartle Hall right now?
Oh, there's so many opportunities for these young professionals just to interact and network with existing professionals and companies out there. There are probably over 300 companies right now in the main Bartle space that are recruiting these African-American and minority engineers. There are workshops and sessions throughout the week, professional development type of things. There's also opportunities for NSBE juniors, so K-12 students, to get involved and actually compete and, you know, compete against different chapters throughout the United States. So there's quite a bit going on throughout the week, and just a real true testament of what we're trying to do in NSBE and in this industry.
Yeah, I do want to ask you one more quick question. I was talking with a friend of mine who's a woman who's an engineer here in town. She is white, but she talks about how she's always outnumbered in the room, 6-1, 7-1 by men. I'm guessing that women, African-American women, are similarly or even more outnumbered in the field. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And are there efforts to improve the diversity of women of color in the engineering world as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say so. And I would give a testimony of Turner Construction. We have a Youth Force 2020 initiative where we actually go out and try to do that very thing. So just introduce engineering and STEM to minorities and young ladies of color, because that's really important. And I think that's the next push in this piece here, is to get, you know, a young African-American woman in a form of leadership in these larger corporations. You know, I think that's the next best thing for us.
Well, hey, I really appreciate both of you taking some time away from the conference to be with us
absolutely.
Today.
Glad to be here.
The National Society of Black Engineers annual convention continues through April 2nd at the Kansas City Convention Center, and you can find out more at convention.nsbe.org. My thanks to Dejan Slaughter and George White Jr. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
You too. So Kansas City, Missouri Mayor Sly James was on this program on Wednesday to talk about his State of the City address. And part of that conversation with Steve Kraske focused on the general obligation bonds, the means by which the city looks to raise $800 million from the city's property owners to continue addressing the backlog of public works projects. The mayor outlined the major areas of infrastructure the funds are meant for if voters approve the bonds at the polls next Tuesday. But the plan does have its critics, and one of them is here today. Patrick Tuohy is the Western Missouri field manager for the Show Me Institute. They describe themselves as the only think tank in Missouri dedicated to promoting free markets and individual liberty. Patrick, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Glad you're here. It's hard to deny that there is a big backlog of public works projects. There's an aging infrastructure in Kansas City, roads that were paved 80 years ago, water mains that were in the ground for a century now. Cities put off tackling a lot of those items. But you're opposed to these bonds. I guess the question is, how could you be opposed for something that's obviously so needed?
Sure. Well, I think you're exactly right, first of all. Anybody who lives in Kansas City knows that there is a great need for infrastructure repair. We have buildings that are collapsing under their own weight. We have crumbling sidewalks, if our streets have sidewalks at all. And the question isn't about whether or not this is a need. But the problem is, the reason why we're here is because for decades, the city council has failed to spend properly, has failed to provide these basic services. And so when they come to the people of Kansas City and say, we want to increase your taxes, and by the way, this may be the biggest tax increase in the history of the city, it's reasonable for the people to say, well, how are you going to behave differently in the future?
But I mean, even if that's true, even if councils for the last 20, 40, 60 years have not done what they should have done, it still has to be done, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. No, again, the problems are there. The question is, how is the city going to spend money going forward? And this city has a real problem with how it collects and spends money. It has a real problem with its economic development policies. And my fear, and the fear of the others at the Show Me Institute, is if we give a big bag of money to the city council without some serious reforms to how they spend, we're going to be having this discussion in another 20 years, in another 40 years, because they will do in the future what they've done in the past, which is get distracted by kind of legacy or a small project, small spending, and not do the basic work.
Well, so here's what they've said. They said that the general obligation bonds are designed the way they are to be collected over 20 years so that future users are involved in paying for the projects that will last for generations to come. Isn't that, a fair way to do this, to raise a lot of money over a long period of time to pay for these needs?
Again, it is. The problem is not, is there a problem? The problem is not how perhaps should the city pay for it. The problem is the city has to change their behavior. What they're asking us for is to give them a lot of money and not change the problem, not change their behavior that got us here.
In a few sentences, then, what is the behavior change you want to see? What should the city be doing differently?
So I think the city, for example, has a real problem with its economic development policy. We decrease the amount of income we get from property taxes because we hand out so many favors to developers in the city. What's going to happen if the bonds pass on Tuesday is, although this tax revenue will be dedicated to infrastructure and these important things, the city will reduce the amount of general fund it spends on those things. City council members have said at these town halls, if this bond passes, it frees up money that we can spend otherwise. That's not what the taxpayers are getting in on. They want to see these problems solved, not allow the city to kind of move money around. Again, that's what got us here. And two more problems with this campaign. The mayor and the city council and the city manager are out around town saying things that are demonstrably untrue. They are saying things about the cost of this to taxpayers, which are untrue. The Star has...
Give me a specific. What's something you say is untrue?
So there is a KCPT documentary that aired last night about water. And in that, at 23 minutes, almost exactly, Troy Schulte said, the cost of this bond to a person who lives in a $140,000 house is $160. That is untrue. KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez has pointed out that is untrue. The Kansas City Star has pointed that out that's untrue. And so what we're being asked to do is trust the council, and they're not running a campaign that is trustworthy.
And to be clear, that reporting by Lisa Rodriguez said that it's possible that it could change over time. If the funding comes in at the current level, that's the total cumulative amount. But you're saying that
the cost
could be changed.
Look, the cost over 40 years, and by the way, this is 40 years of tax increases, not 20. The cost over 40 years to a person who owns that $140,000 house will be over $4,000.
Why do you say it's 40 years of tax increases?
Because what we're voting on Tuesday is a series of 20 different 20-year bonds. The first one will be issued this year. The last one will be issued in 2036 and paid off in 2055. So that's 39, 40 years of taxation. And again, the council is, I think, being too clever by half. They want to present a cheap way to fix problems, but if you just look into the numbers, you see they're not being honest with taxpayers.
Just to push back a little bit, you're saying that the council shouldn't be trusted based on the way that they have spent money up to this point. There is an antidote to that, right? I mean, people will be electing the councils every few years from now into the eternity. Isn't there a built-in accountability? If people don't like the way the councils are spending the money, they can vote them out and vote for a different council.
Well, there is, but it hasn't worked up until this point. And with the council running basically a big trust us campaign, give us $800 million and trust us to spend it right, but the campaign itself isn't trustworthy, voters are absolutely right to say this isn't what we want to get involved in. I think the council needs to come back with much more concrete commitments, not just on the part of taxpayers, but on their part about what's going to be done, how it's going to be done, when it's going to be done. Maybe 20 years of bonds isn't worthwhile. Maybe we do a shorter period and target them. But this big ask for puppies and sidewalks, there is a real need, but I think people are right to be skeptical.
And in fact, one of the questions does ask for $50 million for a new animal shelter and other improvements in Swope Park. Do you then have an alternate plan, Patrick? I mean, obviously you're critical of the one sure. that's on the ballot, but you've also agreed there is this serious infrastructure need. What would the Show Me Institute, what would you have us do?
So what the people of Kansas City kind of already know, but what they need to appreciate is that Kansas City is a high tax city. The Brookings Institution, which is a left-leaning think tank, has pointed out that Jackson, Clay, and Platte counties have higher property taxes than a national average. The Tax Foundation points out that Kansas City is the 15th highest sales tax in the country. And on top of that, we have a 1% earnings tax.
But what would you have us do?
The city isn't starved for cash. The problem is we're not spending it properly. We are distracted by hotels, by streetcars. We want to spend more money on an airport. We give all sorts of tax breaks to big developers. J.E. Dunn, Burns & Mac don't pay property taxes. Yet, by the way, those companies are funding a campaign to have the rest of us increase our property taxes.
So you would take money away from some other things. One of the things you would take it away from is these is tax credits or these development, various economic development initiatives.
So, look, the city needs a dramatic change in the way it taxes and spends, because what it's doing now is we've got very high debt in Kansas City, and we're kind of, it's like going to a payday loan. We're spending all the money we're collecting on things, and then we're just trying to string along.
I mean, I hear your dissatisfaction with the tax practices and also the economic development practices of the city, but I'm still not hearing where enough money would come from to pay for the kinds of infrastructure needs that we've agreed are needed.
So, for example, the first bond is $20 million, right? We're giving Hyatt Corporation $35 million to build their hotel. Okay.
You're talking about through deferred tax credits and things like that.
And a $13 million piece of property. So we're giving them a cash payout. We could simply redirect that stuff to the important things, sidewalks.
Okay, but that one's
streets.
Already done. I mean, are there other things that you see in the future that could change?
See, you're jumping in. We're jumping in right now halfway through the story. I understand you want to know what are the cuts that are going on. You know, what should we do? How should we redirect money? The problem is we've gotten such bad habits in Kansas City that, of course, we can't find any cash. We need to change the way we raise money. We need to change the way we spend money. And we need to focus on basics, not kind of touristy frou-frou.
That's Patrick Toohey with Show Me Institute. He opposes the $800 million general obligation bonds, the GO bonds that will be on next week's ballot. Patrick, thanks for taking a few minutes with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. That's it for Up to Date today. You can download our podcasts and listen to previous programs at kcur.org/up to date. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. I'm at @PTSBrian. And don't forget, you can follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Join us on Monday. We'll speak with political consultant and ABC News political analyst Matthew Dowd. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music, and we had help this week from Linda Scher, Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. Linda Scher is our announcer. Steve Kraske will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.